You're listening to Digital Radio 103, providing diversity and entertainment 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Visit us online at www.digital-radio103.com. The following show comes to you via Digital Radio 103. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual presenters and guests do not necessarily reflect those of this station, the station's network, any other affiliates under this network, or our sponsors.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another installment of The Blurred Line on Digital Radio 103. I'm your host, Sue Shensky, along with my co-host, Matt Haas. How you doing, Matt?
Not very bad. How about you, Sue?
Oh, doing pretty good. Expecting some weather. Not very happy about it.
Well, I know. Oh, dust too down here. Okay. Just going to have to batten down the hatches and see how it goes.
Yep. Well, we are very pleased to have a very interesting guest on the show tonight. Paul Davids is a writer, producer, director, and artist who has had an amazing and storied career. His accomplishments are varied, from writing several Star Wars novels, books of poetry, painting amazing pieces, and writing, producing, and directing films, some to note are Roswell, Jesus in India, The Sci-Fi Boys, and the latest Blood Life After Death project, which we will be specifically discussing tonight. There is so much more to note that I'm afraid we'll never get to the interview. So welcome, Paul. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. I'm sorry you're all having trouble with bad weather, because I'm in Southern California and we're having paranormally wonderful weather right now.
Yes, we're expecting some pretty nasty thunderstorms and possible tornadoes, so I'm not very happy about that.
What state is that then with the tornadoes?
Pennsylvania. I'm in Pennsylvania. Matt's in Maryland, so.
Yeah, I'm just a little south.
Okay. Well, you have a very interesting story to tell with the Life After Death project, and it seems as if you had a little prodding, so to speak, from beyond the grave that prompted you to make the film. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I've always chosen topics for my films when I could do the choosing that really challenge people's thinking, often on very controversial issues. I mean, you mentioned Roswell, the Showtime movie with Kyle MacLachlan and Martin Sheen that I produced. Jesus in India was a challenge to traditional religious point of view. Timothy Leary's Death was one of my first films, actually. That dealt with his proselytizing psychedelics and LSD. And now comes the Life After Death project, which I tell people, I didn't choose this topic, it chose me. I did not expect to make this movie. As a matter of fact, when the event started that caused me to turn my thinking in this direction, I was finishing another film. My previous one before this, Before We Say Goodbye, it's a Latino film with an all-Latino cast, and it deals in part with the mystery of Our Lady of Guadalupe. The Catholic miracle. And around that time, Forrest J. Ackerman, who had been a mentor to me and an extraordinary, important influence in the whole field of science fiction, fantasy, and horror, in literature and film, he passed away at age 92. I had known him since I was a kid. I read the magazine that he edited called Famous Monsters of Filmland. I grew up completely infatuated with Famous Monsters. I had entered a contest of his magazine when I was, I think, 13, amateur filmmaking. I won a prize. I got publicity in the magazine. It went to my head. So I was convinced by the time I was 14 that someday I would be a Hollywood producer. And it turned out to be a good premonition. But not without a lot of other adventures along the way. When I finished my undergraduate work at Princeton, I went to Los Angeles to study at the opening year of the American Film Institute, the AFI, Center for Advanced Film Studies. It was then in Beverly Hills. When I came to California, I started spending a lot of time with Fari. Fari lived in a home he called the Acker Mansion. Mm. It was, there were several Acker Mansions, actually. The first one on I think it was Sherbourne Street in Los Angeles. It was a little smaller than the 18-room, you know, palace that he moved into on Glendower, years later. But I visited all those Acker Mansions that were filled with memorabilia, collectibles, of the whole history of movies going back to the silent days, specifically props from science fiction movies and horror films, masks, makeup kits, animation models, paintings, storyboards, production sketches, scripts, yeah. Stills, photos, color, black and white, a massive library of literature in this field, magazines, the early pulp magazines, science fiction and fantasy, extending on to the years when science fiction started to become a respectable form of literature. And Fari Ackerman, everyone called him Uncle Fari, he had a lot to do with making science fiction respectable and pulling it out of the morass of the pulp magazines. Mm-hmm. He was an agent to a lot of top science fiction writers and helped get Ray Bradbury started, among many others.
Wow.
So I always stayed in close touch with him. He inspired my career. I did write some Star Wars books. I was production coordinator of the Transformers. He was very proud, you know, that I was, you know, one of his, you know, one of the childhood Famous Monsters reader, and I was one of many, many, many readers who were his fans who made good in the business. And then Fari, as he got older, I have to say he made his disbelief in afterlife very clear, you know, to everyone. He was an atheist, and though he wrote about, you know, sort of what we call paranormal, supernatural things, mm-hmm. werewolves, vampires, ghosts, creatures of all kinds, although he wrote about these things, to him it was all, you know, fiction and fun, and he had a great sense of humor, and he would make fun of it all, and do little word twists and wordplay for captions, the photos in his magazine. He was a wonderful guy and generous. Mm. And he finally reached the age of 92, and his body was giving out. His mind hadn't. His mind was always there. And those of us who were close to him, some of us said, you know, Fari, you're an atheist, and What if it turns out that you're wrong about there being no afterlife? Is there any chance of that? And he said, you know, well, I doubt it. He said, but when Prince Sirki comes to take me away, and that was always the way he would describe death, you know, Prince Sirki comes for you, the Dark Lord. he said, when Prince Sirki takes me, you know, if I wake up to some great science fiction convention in the sky, he said, I don't think you'll hear from me right away. He said, you know, I'll be busy with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi and Peter Lorre and George Pal and my dear wife, Wendy. You know, we'll all have reunions. We'll have parties going. He said, but, you know, sometime maybe the partying will die down. And if I can, and if what you say is true, then maybe I'll drop you a line. That was the way he put it. So Fari died December 4th, 2008. And we were all very, very sad. It was a great loss to the field of science fiction and to all those who had been close to him personally. And then a tribute was planned for him a few months later to celebrate his life, March 7th, 2009. And hundreds of people came into Los Angeles to attend the tribute at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, grand old theater, yeah. Historic theater. And many important people spoke there, Ray Bradbury, Guillermo del Toro, Rick Baker was there, Rick Baker, Monster Maker. He's won like 8 or 9 Academy Awards. John Landis was there. Peter Jackson, who did Lord of the Rings, the new King Kong. He checked in from New Zealand by video. And I had a chance to speak. And I had wonderful words for the great contribution that Fari had made to the field and to so many careers, you know, including mine. And that was the tribute. And that's when the weird stuff started. You know, you're the blurred line from reality to the paranormal.
Yeah.
Rod Serling called it the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
And the day of that tribute was the day several of us entered the Twilight Zone with respect to Forrest J. Ackerman. And it has continued now. It's 4 years later. And there is a long list of things that have happened that seem impossible. Some of them, maybe not impossible, but extremely unlikely synchronicities that relate to him. And it feels like he's still around, you know, that he's interacting, that he's doing things, that he's given a message. And in my case, he dropped me the line that he said he was going to drop. He was an editor, and I had a manuscript I was going over when I was alone in the house. And when I was out of the room for 5 minutes, something weird happened to that manuscript. When I came back, there were words blocked out in it with moist ink that wasn't there when I left the room.
Wow.
And that was words that were deliberately chosen, clearly, obviously targeted. This was very precisely blacked out like an editor would do. And blacked out in 2 different levels of darkness. You could still read the first 2 words of the 4 words that were targeted. The next 2 words were completely blacked out. You couldn't read them at all.
And it had to be a little disconcerting.
It was one of the most disconcerting things that had ever happened to me in my life. I had been a little bit prepared for weirdness by the fact that the day of the tribute, I heard from 2 Canadian filmmakers who had made a film about Fari, that they visited his crypt and knocked on it, saying, "Hello, Uncle Fari," rap, rap, rap. And within about an hour, they got back to the hostel they were staying, and they say they got the knock back from him. They heard from him.
Oh, and wow.
They told me how they heard from him. By the way, it's time for a little plug. I have to tell you, your listeners, I can't go on forever without mentioning our website, lifeafterdeathproject.com. You know, the movie that I made as a result of all this, it's been on the Sci-Fi Channel. Then, that was a few weeks ago. Then I finished a sequel. They're together as a DVD set. And it comes out nationally July 16th, but we have them now at our website, and we're sending out, we're filling orders right now at lifeafterdeathproject.com. Okay. And I ask your listeners to please support this effort. It's true. It's honest. This is not Blair Witch.
Yeah.
It's not the fourth kind. I did this project because I had something true to tell that I thought was important for everyone to hear. I didn't exaggerate the facts. I report on all of these weird things that have happened that I think go a long way toward proving that there is life after death, survival of consciousness, after death communication. You know, proof depends upon how high you set the bar.
Mm-hmm.
There are some skeptics that will set the bar so high that if the ghost of their deceased mother appeared in front of them and told them to study more, they'd say, "I was dreaming that."
Yeah. You know?
Reasonable people can deal with something that is a preponderance of the evidence, beyond a reasonable doubt. I really think that's what we've got here. And I welcome the skeptics to have their chance with it. I've met with Michael Shermer. He's in the first movie. He's the publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He is the president of Skeptic Society in Pasadena. We've been face to face on this. I've laid out the events, the evidence. I'm waiting to see what he writes in Skeptic Magazine. He has a big job if he thinks he can explain away 4 years of really strange stuff that seems like it's coming from my friend Forey. And I welcome these events. You know, I've been very happy to have this as part of my life, mm-hmm. you know, because he was so dear to me. And but I didn't seek this. I didn't ask for it. I didn't go looking for it. I certainly didn't manufacture anything.
And that's what
that ink blot, it was just the first. And the communication that the Canadian filmmaker said after wrapping on the grave, that was the beginning, that first week. And it's gone on and on and on and on.
I'm actually on lifeafterdeathproject.com looking at the ink blot there, and that definitely is pretty strange. It's like, yeah. You can definitely see spoke two, and then there's definitely nothing else you can see after that.
Yeah. And, you know, what I'd like people to appreciate is the fact that I sought the help of science about this. Mm-hmm. I have a degree from Princeton. I majored in psychology, but I was pre-med. You know, I took organic chemistry, physics, biology, all of that. When this happened, I felt it was something way out of the ordinary. I certainly couldn't explain it. I knew I was alone in the house. I couldn't imagine any way, anything but what you think of as a ghost, you know, could do something like this.
Right.
Something unseen, with intention, trying to get my attention. I contacted one of the top chemists in the country. His name is Dr. Jay Siegel. He has been chairman of the chemistry department of Indiana University for many, many years. He's a forensic chemist, and he's a specialist in this area, and that is inks, solvents, and paints. Hmm. And he, as a forensic chemist, has testified in many trials where what he has to say about chemical evidence might be the difference between someone going free or going to jail.
Yeah.
He did testify even in the William Kennedy Smith, that rape trial is a famous trial. Many, many trials. So, you know, he's the top. And yeah. He started the test with gas chromatography. And he wasn't satisfied with the information that he was getting just from that. He used a very powerful microscope on this. He studied it with lab assistants. And then he sent me to a colleague at the College of New Jersey, Dr. John Ellison, another professor of chemistry, who used electron microscope and every tool that would be at their disposal to try to dissect the chemistry. And they did learn a lot, but they were extremely baffled about not only how it could have happened, you know, the circumstances, the fact that there was no one else there, but they could not reproduce it, and they tried. They tried to make another ink obliteration like this, mm-hmm. using paper that had been printed on from the same, same computer printer, and John Allison tried that for 3 years.
Wow.
He spent hundreds of lab hours. He used every kind of solvent he could possibly think of. He got students involved in this as a project. You know, from 1 year to the next, students would graduate, and the next class would come in and still deal with the Paul David's ink obliteration. It never went away.
Yeah.
And what did happen was, really, I think it's fair to say, he became haunted. He started experiencing what most people would describe as poltergeist activity.
Oh, wow.
Happening to him while studying this material. You know, was he spooked in the end by this? Yes. Yes. And it started the first day at his lab. We went to his house. He wanted to show me his attempts at obliterations. different solvents he used even before I got there with the original document. And I had the camera rolling, and suddenly a clock on the wall behind him that had been ticking away chimed. And his face went white, and he said, you know, that doesn't happen. The clock hadn't chimed in years. It's never chimed again since. It's a wind-up clock, and neither he nor his wife nor anyone wound that clock up.
Oh.
But it was wound up, you had ticking, you could hear it on, you know, the bell. So that happened. Instances of pages of paper that he'd been experimenting with being scattered across the floor while he went out of the room briefly. He'd come back and see them scattered across the floor when there was no wind, no open windows, mm-hmm. no animals or pets, nothing that could do it. And this in his house when he was alone. Mm-hmm. Let me sort of jump ahead and tell you that as my investigation got deeper and deeper, and as I began to sort of figure out what the ink blot meant and why, I went to the old Acker Mansion. It had been remodeled, new tenants, and they told me the house was haunted. They told me about, you know, the ghost they called Victor who lived there. They told me about seeing his shadow on the wall at night, you know, as though he were walking around the room and into the bathroom, and there was nobody there. One of the gals who was a tenant there, who was a singer, told me she practiced with her music paper on a music stand, and where she kept it, I knew where that was because I remembered the old Acker Mansion. It was right by Fari's old office. And she said she rehearsed singing late at night, and if she left to get a glass of wine or make a phone call, when she came back, she would find her music papers scattered across the floor, like someone picked them up and threw them. And she said, you know, I guess the ghost just didn't like my singing.
I'm saying maybe she should just pick a different piece.
But you see, it's the same thing that happened to the scientist in New Jersey. And, you know, so many things have happened. I can rattle off a few of them. The African mask that was in the house where the ink blot happened was danced in Zimbabwe, was purchased by a collector, was on loan to me, started to give off electromagnetic field readings the day after the ink blot happened, like just going absolutely off the scale.
Wow.
So the guy who owned it, who was living in Santa Barbara then, said, you know what, I keep all my slides, my whole life, meticulously in slide trays, carousel slide trays. The younger generation may not even know what that means, but, you know, when I was growing up, we took Kodachrome slides. We had circular trays for projecting them, and they had a little lock on top of them that would keep the slides in place. So he said, that was 1983 Zimbabwe. I took pictures of that mask when it was being danced by the natives. He said, I want to find those pictures and show them to you, the slides. Well, he had every single slide box that he'd ever taken, including the box for 1983 Zimbabwe. But when he opened it, that was the only box that had the carousel tray in it and no slides.
Oh.
He never would have taken the slides out of the slide tray. No one else in the family is even permitted to go near his stuff. They've never shown up again.
I was going to say, he hasn't found them. Oh.
You know, lifeafterdeathproject.com.
Yes.
That says it all. In our, you know, you have to see the DVDs to see it all, but I have a face mask of Fari. You know, he collected masks, all right? Monster masks, all kinds of masks. At the estate auction, I got this plastic mask of his face that had been on a dummy of him in the Acker Mansion for decades, on top of the clothing he wore. The world's very first World Science Fiction Convention in New York, 1939. He took Ray Bradbury there and got Ray Bradbury started and various editors selling his stories. And this face mask was on top of, you know, the dummy with that clothing. And I have it now. I got a estate auction along with a lot of paintings of him that are in my house and a lot of binders of his early writings and his publicity materials through the decades. So it had never moved from where I put it, the mask, for 4 years of his face. I'll tell you, because it's funny where it is, I have the alien from our movie Roswell, the Showtime movie, the one that was alive in the movie, on display in my office in a large display case. And the mask of Fari sits on top of the display case. Well, the day I got the phone call in the morning, that the phone call saying the film was going to be televised on Sci-Fi, something I've been waiting for and hoping for a long time. I was joyous. I went out to lunch. My wife is at her office. No one else in my house. The doors are locked. The cat's outside. The door to my office is closed. When I came back after lunch, that face mask of Fari had moved 10 feet across the room. It was 10 feet away on the floor in the wires to my hard drives. And there's nothing that could have blown it there. So it's a long, long, long list. I wrote an article for Fate magazine about this. And when I wrote the article, I sent it to them and they went over it, the publisher, the editor, they had proofreaders. But when it was printed, there were these weird misprints in the first page of my article where it stopped saying what I wrote and suddenly it had the words, let me think the exact words. It was the ink blackout in my document, two levels of opacity. And then it gave the words that were blacked out. And then it repeated it again, the ink blackout. In my document, two levels of opacity, meaning two levels of darkness.
Yeah.
Of the ink. I didn't put those words there. They were an interruption in what was in that paragraph. They shouldn't have been there. The publisher doesn't know how they got there, but they're in, you know, a couple tens of thousands of copies of the magazine when it was printed, and it had been proofread.
Wow.
Again, it's like it was a magazine, an issue devoted to the paintings of Frank R. Paul. Fari Ackerman was a foremost collector of the paintings of Frank R. Paul. He would have had a special interest in that issue. That's why they had me write the article for it. And it just called attention to the first strangeness, the first physical anomaly that has baffled the chemists ever since.
Can I get a little bit of validation there?
It's I take it as a validation. Now, the Skeptic Society would take it as a coincidence. You know, they're busy calling Phyllis Galdi to ask about her standards and practices and turning, you know, her documents into the printer and how do they print it and do they have any other misprints like that? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They're looking for however they can bring it down to earth. But it's really.
If it means something to you, then it, you know, it's validation as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Now, in the movie, in the Life After Death project, not only do I involve the scientists at University of Indiana and the College of New Jersey, but I went to the University of Arizona in Tucson to talk to Dr. Gary Schwartz. Who has studied life after death for about 15 years with university supervision. He has studied mediums and has tried to identify the best, those who seem to genuinely have a mediumistic skill, as opposed to those who think that they do, but don't. And he's also studied life after death using computer software he has been developing that he combines with extremely sensitive measuring equipment, sensors that can measure very low levels of gamma rays or can detect few photons of light in a totally dark environment, a box within a black box, within a black box.
Interesting.
You still get a few photons coming through. And when he talks to spirit and he asks for responses, he gets increases in the radiation that is measurable, that can be seen on a graph on the computer screen in real time, as though he's talking and getting yes-no answers from someone who's there but can't be seen.
We need to get one of those ourselves for our group.
Yeah, no.
Yes. Well, it's technology that's being worked on, developed, refined, improved, but it's statistically significant, way above the level of, you know, mere noise.
Yeah.
And in lifeafterdeathproject.com, you'll see it. You'll see that happening in real time in his lab. You'll hear his excited voice just yelling out, there it is, another anomaly, look at that, you know, look at that bar, look at those bars, you know, they're going out of the park. That's such a strong response. That's, you know, Dr. Gary Schwartz. He's written many books. So we also talked to a couple of the mediums that Gary had recommended. They didn't know who I was. I was just the guy who was there with the camera. They were only told that I hoped they might be able to help me communicate with someone deceased named Forrest. That's all they knew. You'll see the movie. You'll see. It's just, I mean, my jaw drops as I look at it because I know how accurate all that stuff was. A psychic from Israel and one from Tucson. We also have one from Australia in the movie. And these people are genuinely gifted.
Mm-hmm.
It just has to be seen to be believed. And it's also fun to see, you know, see in a group, you know, don't just see it alone on, you know, your computer. And speaking of seeing things on a computer, I have to make the statement I make in all my interviews.
Sure.
Every time. There is a terrible thing out there to our business these days, which is film piracy,
mm-hmm.
which is theft of copyrighted material. There are websites that do this. As soon as they can get their hands and do a DVD rip or take things off of television, they put them not just on YouTube. We can get them taken down from YouTube. But lots of sites. Some of these sites give your computer a virus. Others, they make you jump through a lot of hoops and pay the money and do all kinds of things only to find out that they don't really have the movie you're looking for. And I say to everyone, this destroys the business of independent filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe that the kind of work I'm doing and others are doing that's very serious in these fields should continue to be done, we can't do it without your support. You know, we don't survive from what comes from like having a movie on Sci-Fi or another cable network. It takes people who want to own the DVDs, you know, and will order them in order to be able to recoup the expenses it takes to do something like this for 4 years.
Absolutely.
So enough said. I ask for your support and I appreciate it.
And they can get the film at lifeafterdeathproject.com. I know I will be ordering my own copy.
Yes, you know, at our website, it's now not even middle of June yet, and the DVDs it came into the warehouses just a few days ago. So we're starting to ship the pre-orders now at lifeafterdeathproject.com.
Great.
Whereas every other website out there, and there will be lots of them legally selling this DVD, but starting July 16th is when they'll ship. They're taking pre-orders, but it'd take another month. We're doing it right now. And we send it all around the world. It's what we call region free. So, you know, the DVDs that we're providing will, you know, they'll work on any NTSC player or computer in Australia, England, Germany, France, wherever.
Great. Well, I think we're gonna take a quick break. We're gonna pay some bills, and we will be right back in a couple minutes. Stay tuned, everyone. Welcome back, everyone, to The Blurred Line. I am Sue Shensky, and along with Matt Haas, you're listening on Digital Radio 103. And we have Paul Davids with us tonight, and we're talking about his latest project, the Life After Death Project. And we've discussed a lot of interesting information, but we do want to make sure we discuss what's coming up next. also involved with this DVD. So what is coming up next with this DVD?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Oh, you have some additional things coming with the DVD.
Oh, well, what it is this. There's the first movie, Life After Death Project, that was on Sci-Fi in the middle of May. And I had so much material when I was making that movie, so many other people I had talked to, so many other cases of evidence for life after death. Wonderful experts, you know, doctors, nurses, archaeologists, librarians, you know, people from all walks of life who had experiences of after-death communication and evidence that satisfied them that life goes on in another form after, you know, the body is deceased. And I didn't want to leave all this material on the cutting room floor, so I created a sequel to release at the same time as the movie. The sequel, which comes in the same DVD package, it's a two DVD set, the Life After Death Project. The sequel is Life After Death Project 2, Personal Encounters. And for most of it, you're simply hearing from, as they say, these people from all walks of life who have had incredible and astonishing things happen to them that personally prove this to them. And they're getting to tell their information, their experiences, in, you know, with very little interruption, you know, no special effects, no corny sound effects like you have on the Ghost Hunter shows on television.
Right.
I mean, one of the things about my approach here was, you know, there are no special effects. This is just, I'm just providing real information.
Honest,
you know, real people, real evidence, real incidents. It doesn't need a lot of zooms and swishes in the background, you know, or hokey music or fast cuts that are as though designed for people with attention deficit disorder. I as one critic of the film said, you know, that the adults were in charge in this movie. And I think everybody's going to be really pleased with it. So in number two, we not only meet all of these, the variety of people and experts on things like reincarnation, which is some of the cases and evidence is discussed by Paul von Ward, for example. Colonel John B. Alexander. Yes, who is doctor also, because he's a PhD. Kennedy School of Government, a very distinguished person with very strong military connections, who has been a skeptic on a lot of the aspects of the UFO phenomenon. So people in that field sort of regard him as, gee, you know, he's military, you know, is he one of the men in black? Well, it happens he has this incredibly intense interest in life after death. And he studied with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the psychiatrist who brought hospice to America, and was one of the first to bring these phenomena we're talking about out of the closet and get doctors talking about them, get students talking about them, these weird or unusual things that happen. Was that a dog or a werewolf in the background?
That was my dog, apologies.
Okay. Yes, this is meant for you to hear too. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had witnessed a full-blown bodily manifestation of one of her deceased students who visited her subsequently after she died, and she came to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and she encouraged her to continue her work, and she signed her name in a book for her, and it was her previous student who promptly vanished when she went out into the hallway, and Dr. Kubler-Ross poked her head out to the hallway, and never to be seen again. That kind of report of a full-blown bodily manifestation, you know, not like in spirit, like a ghost, but it's as if they're back. It has been reported from time to time. And in Life After Death Project 2, I have a psychologist in there, Dr. Stanislav Ojak, who experienced such a bodily manifestation of his deceased wife, who had died in his arms, in fact. And she appeared first, he was in America, but she appeared first to a friend of his in New Zealand. And the friend was really freaked out. Yeah. As a matter of fact, the friend began by saying, you know, I never met your wife, but, you know, I think I saw her in a dream. And when Stanislav Ojak actually went to New Zealand to visit his friend picked him up at the airport and said, you know what, when I told you I saw her in a dream, I wasn't telling the truth. I saw her. She was there.
Oh.
She came to me. And you want to know why I'm an hour late picking you up at the airport? She came back.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
And then Stanislav Ojak had a full-blown bodily manifestation of his wife when he was back in America in his bedroom. And she vanished when his current wife walked into the room.
Oh, wow.
And he tried to tell her, honey, you know, I got to tell you, you know, what just happened, you know. And he starts to tell her, and she says, that's nice. Breakfast is ready.
Just kind of brush it off.
Well, I know UFO researchers who are, you know, very serious about their topic, who are married to women who are very tolerant of their research, but they'll try to tell them about a case, and the response will be, honey, I know the aliens are here to eat us. I just hope they don't eat me. I've got a nail appointment in an hour. I don't want to be late for my nail appointment. ordinary life goes on. But the other thing I want to tell you about Stanislav is he's had a whole history his whole life of being able to take photos with a lens cap on the camera.
Oh, wow.
It's like, okay, anyone in photography is going to say that's impossible, right? And when I first heard it, I said, yeah, okay. I'm a photographer. You know how much light gets through the...
Exactly.
You know, the lens with the lens cap on? And then he showed me his pictures, and then he said, for validation, I want you to talk to Bill Tiller. All right. Bill Tiller, who is in What the Bleep Do We Know, is a PhD who was many years a full professor of physics in materials, material scientist at Stanford University, who met Stanislav Ojak, saw his photos, and said he wanted to run experiments and test with this. And he validated it all.
Oh, wow.
That Stanislav can do this. They took pictures. They set up cameras in a chapel at Stanford. And the pictures with the lens cap on came out better than the ones that didn't.
That's amazing.
He attributes this to something very advanced about Stanislav's personal biofield.
Mm.
Stanislav is an unusual man. You know, he's a Baha'i. He meditates every day. He's very into spiritual practices. But you have this evidence in these photos. And speaking of this kind of evidence, I have to tell you about Dr. Lynn Katai, medical doctor, Phoenix, a very fascinating person who had all kinds of strange activities happen when her mother died. You know, the electricity of the refrigerator went out in the house, but nothing else in the kitchen, and the power went out in her son's room, but one light was still on, but the light was blue, and the light was getting lighter and darker and lighter and darker. And this was, you know, after they just put her mother in the ground. And 10 years later, 10 years to the day from when her mother died, her son goes out and buys a Siamese kitten like the one they used to have with her mother. And he starts taking some pictures of it. Now, he doesn't use a digital camera. He doesn't use regular film. He has what is called a Polaroid iZone camera, which takes small pictures. And, you know, the Polaroid would be instant photography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you pull the strip out and you can't double expose it. The right. camera's built so you can't do a double exposure, and you have to pull each one out before you take the next picture.
Mm-hmm.
You give it, you know, 15 seconds or a minute to develop, and you peel it back, and there's your picture. So her son took pictures of the new kitten, the Siamese cat, just like the one they used to have with her mother. And in one of these pictures, there are the ghostly hands, you can see through them, the arms and hands of a woman holding her arms around the cat as though cupping it, and almost as though holding it. And she gasped when she saw the picture because she said, look, my mother was arthritic. She had arthritic deformed hands. Look at the right hand in that picture. You see the deformity? That's my mother's hand.
Wow.
She's been dead for 10 years. She died 10 years ago today, and there she is cupping the new kitten that's just like the one that she had. Ghost photo, anybody?
Yeah, you really.
Know? You know? Mm-hmm. Physical evidence, anybody? Hello, yeah. Skeptic Society, are you listening? Are you,
they're
are you getting your armor together and ready for the battle? Because we've got a battle here.
Yeah. Sounds
I don't mind skepticism. It's an intelligent approach to take to everything. No one likes to be bamboozled.
Sure.
But it's also a kind of, maybe this isn't the right word, but I want to say, you know, sacrilege in the face of really good evidence to either keep denying the evidence or attack the person that's bringing the evidence.
Yeah. Agreed.
You know? So, people, listeners, thank you for hearing this. Please go to lifeafterdeathproject.com. And for the small price we're offering, let us send you the double DVD set. It is also 40 minutes of bonus features that includes Ray Bradbury and Rick Baker, Academy Award winner. And all in all, over 4 hours about this evidence for life after death that I've personally been, what should I say, dragged into, not kicking and screaming, because I love Barbie Ackerman, and he can visit me anytime. He's always welcome. The door is always open to him, and if my door is closed, he's welcome to come right through the door.
I think he has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Paul, for being on the show. I wish we had more time, but everybody, I for one can't wait to get my copy. And just to repeat that, it's lifeafterdeathproject.com. Everyone, please go there, support this project. It's very important to get real stories and real evidence out there so people can
Do I have time for one more short 30-second comment?
Absolutely.
Please also check out my last film, which is called Before We Say Goodbye. Especially all Hispanic Americans, if you're Latino, it's about the culture. It's about a grandma who has religious faith, Catholic, believes in tradition, and the miracle of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and uses that to hold her family together, to try, and is in search of a miracle. I love the stage play. It's a really heartwarming film, and it really is a great cross-cultural, you know, aid that brings the Anglos close to the Latinos and vice versa. It's called Before We Say Goodbye, and the DVD is out there too.
Great. Well, thank you again so much, and I really, really enjoyed our conversation tonight. Really enjoyed hearing the stories, and I'm sure everyone else did too. Stay tuned, everybody. Next week, 8 o'clock, we will have some more great conversation and more great topics. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful rest of the week, and enjoy the weekend.
We thank you for listening. The show which you have just heard is protected by international copyright laws, and all rights are reserved and as such may not be copied, recorded, or re-aired in any form whatsoever without written permission from the station's management.